Is that because of the legality or because it's not authentic to the original experience, like playing it on an LCD screen where it just looks
There's
horrible?
there are mixed views on that. They for example, some of them call the emulator users emula pobre, which is a mix of emulator and poverty.
Poverty?
Yeah.
So it's like the poor man's gaming
Yeah.
console. Okay.
Well, welcome back to another episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug. This is, or is going to be, episode 78. And, as always, it is brought to you, as are all of our episodes, by our Patreon backers. So thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and the Codex by that means. And as always, a hearty thank you to our co-producers, Seth, Dominic, Chris, Violation, Adam, Avatars Radio, Eric, Thor1, Pascal, Neil, Helgruff, Aaron, and the Hearth of Britannia. Quick check. Do I have any new Ultima Dragons this week? Oh, I do. We welcome a few new members to the Facebook group. Christopher, Ryan, Arturo, Santre, Lars, David, and Thomas. So, I'm actually going to do another thing like I did a couple of episodes ago where I'm basically going to just introduce us and then leave again. But there is actually one thing that I wanted to... You know, I run my other podcast, right? The Scouting Podcast. And it's funny because I was going through and I know on the Canadian charts that podcast is actually in the top 200 for the government and organizations category. And I was looking again today and it's actually Scouting Stuff is number 165 on the top 200 Canadian podcasts under the government and organizations category. So that's pretty cool. And actually, if you drill down further into the nonprofit subcategory, the podcast ranks at number 72, which, you know, on the one hand, isn't that impressive, but given how many thousands of podcasts are out there, even in these more niche sounding categories, number 72 is pretty good. The top 200 seems to be how Apple, like for whatever reason, Apple has just chosen like top 200 as their thing. So, okay. I am in the top 200 of a couple categories on the Canadian store with the Scouting Podcast. I'm happy about that. And then I started looking around and I actually, I'm doing even better in the UK, under government and organizations that the podcast ranks at, number 115. And it's just about cracking the top 50 for the nonprofit category. It also ranks in Australia and in Ireland and in the US in the nonprofit category. So I was really, really happy to see all that. And of course, Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug does not rank anywhere near as high as that in the video games category. Now, a lot of that just has to do with saturation, right? Because there's a hell of a lot more video game podcasts than some other categories of podcast. So, you know, as a result, I mean, like, we're not Giant Bomb, we're not Dude Soup, we're not any of those. So we're not going to, Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug is probably never going to crack the top 200. But anyways, all of this is kind of a long preamble to saying that I actually found a couple of neat web apps that allow me to track from one location all of the comments, like all of the reviews that I get on iTunes and Stitcher, and also let me track all of the any changes in rank. Like, you know, so if the podcast ever does crack into the top 200, I'll know about it. But one thing was, you know, whereas I do have some reviews for the Scouting Podcast, I don't currently have any reviews on iTunes for Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug. So I really do invite the listening audience, ye Ultima Dragons, who do tune into this on a regular or semi-regular basis, please do consider leaving us a review on iTunes, especially iTunes, because of course that seems to have the most effect on podcast rank. If Yeah, that was actually really my big request. Was, you know what? Please do consider leaving us a review. All right. So again, like a couple of weeks ago, I'm not going to be able to stick around for much of the recording because there's a whole pile of stuff that I got to take care of tonight. And my wife needs a hand with some things. It's just a weird week for us. It really is. But let's quickly introduce who's on. We'll do a quick recap and then I'll maybe just randomly grab a topic out of the channel and leave you guys to discuss it and whatever else. So we are joined tonight by Golden Flame Dragon.
Hello.
Grenadilla Dragon is also with us tonight.
Hey, good evening, everyone.
And Boolean Dragon is back again. Missed you last week, man.
Did you? I don't know. My life is complicated, too. I didn't even realize. But yeah, I'm here.
Mm-hmm. And your internet's working again. So yay win.
Yeah, that's true. It's amazing how terrifying it is to lose your internet. You don't really know until it happens. And then you're just like, wow, this is like so important to me. And I just took it for granted.
I get it. I really do. How's your week been? Just briefly.
It's been good. Just a bunch of 240p stuff, working with Mike Cheese, Raspberry Pi hat. I got my 4-port, both composite and S-Video switch, so I can test my Super Nintendo against the Raspberry Pi and all that good stuff. And I saved my house, as I mentioned before we started the official podcast. I saved my house from getting destroyed by a giant tree, so that was fun. That was yesterday. And that's about it.
Yeah. Well, yes. I may actually wind up using whatever I got of the story of the giant tree for the intro because it's kind of a thing.
Good idea. It was crazy. I got a video of it, but anyway.
Oh, cool. I hope that hits your YouTube at some point.
It's there.
Oh, well, there you go. Good idea. How's your week been?
It's been okay. Nothing much done.
All right, fair enough. How about yourself, Golden Flame?
Today I finished a really annoying project at work, and behind me I've got a couple of stacks of Kickstarter backer rewards that I'm gonna schlep to the post office on Monday and hope that I printed out all of the postage stuff properly.
Wow. Well, good luck with that. I earnestly hope it goes well for you. Myself, my gosh, like this whole week, I can't even really describe it. Like it's just been, and it's funny because, you know, like we had the Beaver Scouts out at camp last weekend, like I think I mentioned on the last podcast. And so I didn't even have a Beaver meeting on Monday, but just like it's been, I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that, you know, like my wife is still, she's still pregnant, so that's good. Baby's still seemingly healthy, and that's a good thing. And she's trying to do what she can to maintain her health. But equally, it's very, you know, like she runs out of energy much more quickly in this pregnancy than with any of the other three. So, like I know Wednesday night, I was up until midnight just tidying up the house and doing dishes and stuff like that. Tuesday, I don't even remember what I was doing on Tuesday. It's just gone from lack of sleep. And then last night as well, it was just a mess. So, on the other hand, I did find time to reset all of my home router settings and like tweak the channels that my Wi-Fi was on and adjust bandwidths and set up OpenDNS Family Shield. So I'm happy about that because I really wanted to get that done in advance of when I have to look at getting my daughter a Chromebook. I'm a paranoid parent, but then again, I work in cybersecurity, so I have every reason to be paranoid about what's out there on the internet. Yeah. So that was my week in a nutshell. Well, we were going to talk about Planescape Torment tonight, but I'm going to actually punt that a couple of weeks and just throw out some random... I've put a bunch of other links into the linkage channel. I'm only going to start with the first one, which is... Remember that? You know how there's all... It's kind of a much lambasted topic now. You know, this whole idea, oh my gosh, video games cause violence. And... Like I say, I think we mostly laugh at the idea right now, but there were a few studies published that purported to suggest a link between playing video games and having a higher propensity to perpetrate real-world violence. Two of those studies have been yanked. They have been pulled. The first study was titled Boom, Headshot. Now, doesn't that just sound scholarly? And it was originally published in the Journal of Communication Research in 2012. This was, I guess it was by a, oh, okay. So anyways, more recently, a psychology professor at Villanova University, one Patrick Markey, discovered inconsistencies in the study's data and went on to discover that the results seemed to be positively skewed. He and a colleague alerted Ohio State University, which is where the research was conducted, and then the study's lead author, Brad J. Bushman, emailed the university suggesting that the allegations surrounding data inconsistencies were a smear campaign, part of a smear campaign by Dr. Markey. The original research, however, was not available to double-check. And ultimately, a committee of inquiry at OSU recommended that the study be retracted. The second study, Effects of Violent Media on Verbal Task Performance in Gifted and General Cohort Children, now that does sound more scholarly, which was also actually conducted by Professor Bushman, faced similar issues. This was discovered by a Joseph Hilgard, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. He thought that the data was outside of the typical ranges one would expect in normal psychology research, and he found that Professor Bushman, OSU, and others he contacted regarding the study were helpful, but they were unable to provide the specifics of the data collection process. Are you starting to see a pattern here? The author tasked with gathering the data now, I guess, resided in Turkey, was no longer in contact with the people running the study, so it was impossible to verify the integrity of the study, and it too was retracted. Now that said, Professor Bushman does still have other work published on the topic, Effects of Violent Video Games on Aggressive Behavior, Aggressive Cognition, Aggressive Effect, Psychological Arousal, and Pro-Social Behavior, a Meta-Analytic Review of the Scientific Literature. So that's another of the papers, I guess, that he has published. And he currently teaches a bunch of courses at OSU. I basically just read an entire TechRaptor article on this. So consider all of what I just said one big quote. But anyways, it would seem that we're starting to identify an issue, at least with this particular professor's methodology, his research methodology, and some of the conclusions he's drawn. So I throw that out there for brief discussion. And if there is no discussion, you all are welcome to move on to something else, like, say, Super Nintendo games that have been unearthed after far too long in the dark. But for myself, I've never really particularly believed that, you know, there is a positive correlation between playing video games and committing violent acts. I just don't see it bear out in all the people I know who play video games. And I know a lot of people who play video games. So statistically speaking, if it was a thing, it'd probably be something that, you know, I'd have noticed by now. If it was actually something that happened, was, you know, fairly prevalent phenomenon in the world. And to be fair, there have actually been other studies that I'm aware of that, you know, seemed to contraindicate the conclusions of Professor Bushman et al.
Yeah, based on what I know as far as what causes people to behave violently, is people who have been the victims of repeated psychological and physical abuse at a young age. And people like that would certainly be drawn to violent video games and actually might enjoy them a little bit differently than someone who had a better childhood might enjoy them, which is in a, you know, a healthier manner, as opposed to some sort of, like, you know, like violence as pornography in order to satisfy this desire in them to actually commit real acts of violence. But as far as somebody who hasn't been psychologically damaged, you know, who's perfectly normal by society standards, playing a bunch of violent video games and suddenly, strangely feeling the urge to actually commit violence in real life. Like, I've never seen any hint of that in myself, or as far as I can tell, any other person. And obviously that's just, you know, anecdotal evidence. I haven't conducted a study that got retracted because, you know, I was just making shit up, as apparently happened here. But, you know, I haven't seen any evidence whatsoever that that's true.
Well, I guess studies, there are always a lot of studies which do nothing more than promote a specific agenda. We always see it, and there's a lot of bullshit studies which have no basis, which are just a bunch of lies, and they were paid by someone with an agenda.
I figure it's not surprising if there's a correlation between violent video games and violence, but I am very surprised if there's a causation that goes in the direction of video games to real world. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And like what Gradio was saying, like I don't know this college professor involved in these studies here. I don't know if he was getting paid, so he had the resources to actually conduct these studies. But you know, scientists and researchers and people that do studies like this, they have to get funding from somewhere, obviously to eat, to live, but also to actually be able to have the resources to conduct the research. And, let's say there is an organization that receives funds from people and they do have an agenda for whatever reason. And they pay for a study. Well, that's a bit of a conflict of interest because the person doing the study, of course, is supposed to be objective and unbiased, but at the same time, they need this money to live. So they might be subconsciously, pressured to have the study go a certain way, whether they intended it to or not. Or, of course, even worse, if they were just completely unethical, they could be awesome, more money. I'm going to go ahead and do this exactly like I know they want me to and, try to make it look legit.
I think it's not really like that. It's just the people conducting the study, they usually just receive the money and the document telling them what to research or what questions to ask. So even if they are honest and objective people, they are being asked to obtain specific metrics. They usually don't have any say on what information they're gathering. They are told exactly what to measure, and that is biased by the one requesting the study.
So the very premise of the study would be biased then, basically.
Yeah, and I think there's an issue here. I often hear the idea that power corrupts. I think that's bullshit. That's a complete lie. I think the corrupt people caters to where there is power. Corrupt people always look for the easiest way to get power, and they use that power to abuse other people.
So you think Machiavelli was wrong then? I think he's the one who had the famous line, right?
Well, it requires a deeper understanding of human nature. See, power, what it does is it enhances your qualities. If you're corrupt, power makes that bigger. If you're not corrupt, if you are, people of goodwill, your ability to act on goodwill is enhanced. And the same, if you have bad will, if you're corrupt, power gives you an enhancement to your ability to act and do wrong.
So power then is a coefficient to corruption. That's mostly true, perhaps. But I think at the same time, even if you're a good person, like normal people, everybody gets out of line every now and then. And usually somebody is there to correct them, like, hey, man, take it down a notch. What are you doing? There's repercussions. With if you have like ultimate power, if you have a lot of power, people are not going to do that to you. You're not going to get that natural feedback when you step over the line from people because they'll be afraid of the repercussions of them criticizing you or keeping you in check. And with that missing, you might accidentally forget that you even overstepped at all and get used to it.
Well, that has to do with something else. That's, for example, when we're talking about social movements, for example, or social and political movements, like, for example, the Nazi, we often see, I think most people or the average person thinks they were evil and they thought themselves as evil. Well, the truth is the most evil acts are perpetrated by people believing they are doing good. So the Nazis didn't believe themselves as bad people. They thought they were doing right. But it's
most people don't think they're bad people, no matter what they're doing.
Yeah, they simply lost the ground and didn't see what they were doing. There's an issue with the way people think. It's very easy for people to just feel supported by others when there are a lot of numbers. They just turn stupid by being too many. It's some kind of laziness.
Mob mentality?
Yeah, it's a kind of laziness on the brain. It's one thing. See, originally, people, including myself, I thought that intolerance and all of that behavior came exclusively from religious people or people from specific political views. But that's not true. Intolerance comes from every group, even religious, atheists, non-religious people. What is it that made religions create that kind of issue? They are groups. They are huge groups of people. Now we have the internet. With the internet, it's very easy to meet other people with a similar way of thinking than you. So what has been happening is that now we have a lot of intolerant atheists. Why? Because with the internet, it's much easier to meet other atheists and form a sort of group where you say something and there's a lot of people who agree with you. And if you're just a person who doesn't think things deeply, who doesn't take the time to reason things, you end up believing you are right. And you feel empowered because there's other people who agree with you, and then it becomes a group of intolerant people. So,
well, the internet facilitates people's instincts. So instead of it bringing different people together to have rational conversation, which is, you know, idealistically, if you'd never heard of the internet before and somebody told you about it, that would be the first thing you would think about it. Ironically, it does the opposite. It allows people to self-segregate according to common interests and beliefs. And basically, I don't know if circle jerk is the right term. That's a little bit profane, but, you know, it kind of allows them to just keep reinforcing their own like-minded ways over and over again. And as soon as somebody comes in with a different opinion, they immediately get attacked. And, you know, it's like, I'm going to unfriend you because you didn't vote for who I voted for. All of my friends are now exactly like me, and they pretend to have these interesting conversations when, in fact, they're just repeating each other over and over and over again. And, you know, you see that on Facebook. You see that on Twitter. And we've gotten, like, way off course from talking about violence in video games here.
Oh, it's related. But,
okay. Related. Okay, well, tie it back in, Gurdia, because I'm lost, man. I'm on the end of the diving board of tangents here.
Well, now I'm going to tie it back to the topic. So we're talking about if violence is directly related, if violence in video games is directly related to violence in real life.
Yeah, does it cause people to act violently in real life, basically, yeah.
Well, it all has to do with power. See, inside a video game, you have power. Outside of the video game, you don't. So even if the person is inherently violent, what makes him or her exert the violence inside the video game doesn't translate into the real world because they lack the same power in the real world. The exceptions are made with people with mental issues who don't have the ability to differentiate between video games, TV programs, anime, cartoons, and real life. And there are other things, other aspects related to it, but it's it all revolves to a mental issue. It's only the violent video games are a danger to people with mental issues or people with a certain degree of power in real life.
I think they'd be more like an outlet for it. I mean, if you have violent impulses and you're smart enough to know that if you go out on the street and just start doing violence on people, that, you know, first, they could fight back and kill you or injure you seriously. And second, there's probably going to be witnesses. People are going to call the cops. You're going to go to jail. That would probably prevent you from doing it. And that speaks to the power you were talking about. They don't have the power because, you know, civilization has more power than they do as an individual. And there are rules that they know that they can't break. But, you know, as far as somebody who does not have these issues and then they play video games and now they have these urges, it just doesn't make any sense.
I'll tell you something. I have a friend and he has a kid, and one day he was playing Grand Theft Auto. I don't remember which one of them, but Grand Theft Auto. And he took a break to go to the restroom. And when he came back, his child was playing the game. He was beating an old man with a baseball bat.
Yes.
And my friend, well, he never allowed his child to play Grand Theft Auto. So right. He said, "Hey, what are you doing?" And his kids say, "Oh, this game is awesome."
I know.
But the kid would never really beat an old man with a baseball bat in real life.
Right. They understand. Even a small child understands. And surely there is a limit on this. Like, I have a 4.5-year-old boy, Jeffrey. And, you know, I took great pains as early as he could understand to basically explain to him the nature of the world he was living in, you know, from a cosmic scale, you know, of Earth as a planet and the solar system and the galaxy and, you know, the other galaxies and, you know, the scale of the universe, and trying to explain time to him and civilization and society and the rules and the different cultures and nations and just everything I could possibly think of, you know, basic principles in science and physics, and also the nature of entertainment, like television and films, and like what acting was and how they would create a television show using multiple cameras, and, you know, that the actors, they're like, "Hey, it's like your Uncle Chad and Aunt Stacy. It's like they're actors." Right. So they pretend to be somebody else in front of a camera so they can put the show together so people can watch it and have a good time. So I explained all of this to him, you know, as early as possible. So there would never be a time where he had this epiphany of, "Oh, my God, all this stuff I've been seeing on TV actually isn't real." And his understanding of that actually allows him to appreciate things in a way that's safer, because whether it's a video game or a television show or a movie, he is able to put it in the context of this artfully created fantasy that's not real, that serves one purpose, and that is for his own amusement. And I think a lot of parents, rather than actually doing that, they simply prevent their kids from being exposed, you know, to anything other than Barney or something. So, you know, like I showed, it was, I think it was like the latest Terminator movie. Forget which one, but it starts off, it shows San Francisco getting nuked, right? Shows like the Golden Gate Bridge with the cables flying everywhere and a giant, you know, surge of the ocean just knocking it down. And it's just like this impressive, just over the top scene. And he loved it. You know, he absolutely loves stuff like that. You know, he loves the action scenes. He likes to watch people fighting. But, he, you know, he is the sweetest, kindest, you know, most empathetic person, you know, one of the most, you know, one of the nicest people that I've ever seen. You know, he shares, he's nice, he doesn't get in fights, you know, he feels bad for people when they get hurt. So even at 4.5, you know, he can fully separate these two things. And when you start talking about like teenagers and adults, these video games are somehow making them want to go out and shoot up a school. You know, oh, Columbine happened because they played Doom. It's just so simplistic. It's just so ridiculous. It's disappointing that it's gotten as much attention as it has.
I guess in the end, it's a matter of people actually knowing the difference between something real and a game or a movie.
Yeah, that, and again, like not being like, you know, burned with cigarettes and abused and beaten, you know, their entire childhood. You know, people like that, those are the ones that grow up to be serial killers, essentially. But let's see, I'm going through some of the stuff here, some of the other links that Withstand the Fury Dragon threw up. Got Super Nintendo prototype Quick the Thunder Rabbit uncovered. It's like it's an Amiga game that they ported to the Super Nintendo. And apparently they found a prototype of it that was never released, which is buggy and crashes at some point. There was some other game, I can't remember what it was, that was mentioned earlier that was found like 15, 20 years later. It was mentioned in one of the previous podcasts. So that is interesting. Now I'm in the podcast by myself. Golden Flames, AFK, Gritty is quiet.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And looking at the other links.
Yeah, we got to save Kenneth some... some super, super long silence editing here, which you could probably automate, actually.
Bloodstained Ritual of the Night, Wii U canceled, coming to Nintendo Switch instead.
That doesn't surprise me. I don't know. This
surprised me either. I don't remember which game engine they're using, but I think I have a vague memory that it was probably Unreal Engine. That actually works on Switch, but doesn't Wii U.
Well, that's odd. I hope they weren't developing the game for two different systems in tandem using different engines. That would be crazy.
Yeah.
But I don't know what kind of sales figures the Wii U ultimately got. Do you have any idea, Gradia, how successful that system was? It looks like not terribly, because they came out with the Switch basically so quickly after the Wii U. It was like a couple of years. But yeah, I'm just glad they're still working on it. I mean, between, what was it, Mighty Number 9 just being an abject failure, it still blows my mind how that's even possible. I mean, we're talking about Mega Man. Mega Man is not the most complex game in the world. You know, if your job was, hey, make a game that's cool, like Mega Man 2 or Mega Man X for Super Nintendo, I mean, then they're not asking you to make Ultima 6. There's a few things that make it work. It has a few unique characteristics that make it work. It has decent level design. You know, it's obviously got the snappy, catchy music. It's not rocket science. So how that failed, I have no idea. So that was a shame to see that go down in flames. And I've watched some of the pre-alpha footage from Bloodstained Ritual of the Night. And while it looks okay, I actually started to get that same vibe that I'd gotten with Mighty Number 9. Like, I'm not sure that they actually completely know what they're doing if what they're trying to do is replicate the experience of Symphony of the Night for PSX. You know, it looked good, but at the same time, it sure as hell didn't look as good as Symphony of the Night. It didn't even, like, the animation, the timing, the mechanics for jumping and all of that. So, I don't know. What do you think from what you've seen so far, Gradia?
Well, I haven't seen anything updated recently, but I think there are always a lot of things that need tweaking, and they they usually keep tweaking them throughout the development. So I would need to check on the newer one.
Yeah, it looks, it might just be the art style that I have a problem with. They're using, it's polygonal, you know, so they're using actual 3D graphics. It is not pixel art. But at the same time, it looks like, in a way, they're trying to make it look like pixel art, or at least look like it's cel shaded, like, you know, like an anime, like a cartoon. And I've never been a big fan of that. You know, if you want to make something look like a cartoon, actually use 2D artwork, or worst case scenario, like splines or something like that. But, you know, don't use polygons and then try to dumb it down to make it look like it's some sort of hand-drawn cartoon. It just looks weird. But I'm still looking forward to seeing it completed.
That technology.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, like go watch some anime from the 1980s or from the early 90s, and then go watch the new stuff where they try to still make it look like it's cell artwork, where they actually had, you know, transparent slides that they hand-painted and they layered together, compared to the newer stuff that's actually done on computer, but they try to make it look like that, and they're actually just interpolating animation between keyframes of splines. And it looks very, very clean, very, very smooth. They have the nice frame rate, but you can tell that it's not hand-drawn. So I'd rather they go one direction completely or the other. When you're trying to do both at the same time, there's just something inherently dishonest and shitty about it, in my opinion. But we'll see. It's not finished. Just like Shroud of the Avatar, just like Star Citizen. Let's see, speaking of Star Citizen, the next news item is interesting.
Yeah.
It says they're dropping support for DirectX 12 in favor of Vulkan, the Vulkan API, which I actually know very little about the Vulkan API. I think it's an NVIDIA technology. Is that correct, Gridia? Do you know?
I haven't looked deeply on it. But I'm not really familiar with that, but someone once told me that there was a new application program interface, which was the successor of OpenGL, but actually done right.
Yeah, actually, you're right. I'm looking at it now. Yeah, it is done by Kronos Group. Yeah, it's done by Kronos Group, the OpenGL guys. So open standard originally was going to be called OpenGL Next. Well, this is fantastic news because I've been all right. Golden Flame's dipping out, so it is now, as he mentioned, the Kevin and Gridia show, and he's gone. So goodbye, Golden Flame. It's like everybody's having emergencies tonight, except for you and I. But okay. Yeah, like for as long as I can remember, I've always been disturbed that developers would actually choose to use and focus on DirectX over OpenGL. And now I understand that Microsoft is this huge juggernaut, and if they want you to use their proprietary stuff that doesn't work on other systems, unless they want it to work on other systems, so sure, there's sort of pressure to do that. But the fact that you have OpenGL, which will run on anything, literally any system, you know, from big to small, you know, open spec, open source, you can do whatever you want to with it, supported by all video cards everywhere and chipsets. Mm-hmm. And then you have DirectX, which only runs on what Microsoft wants you to run it on. Oh, and they're not compatible with each other. Why the hell would somebody voluntarily lock themselves in as a developer to use DirectX instead of OpenGL? So this
actually,
is awesome
a lot
news.
Of ignorance. Actually, there's a lot of ignorance. I'll tell you.
Never, never. What do you mean? There's no ignorance anywhere.
I was talking to a computer science student, and he was showing something, and I asked him why DirectX and not OpenGL. It was several years ago, and he was talking about how it looked better on DirectX with the video card he was using and blah, 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 blah. And I told him, hey, do you want to program video games? And he said, yes, I want to. And then I told him, well, you are not learning what you should. The OpenGL is what you would use on any platform, on any console. DirectX is Windows only. It's Xbox only. And he just looked at me and he was like, he wasn't thinking things through. And he didn't know where OpenGL was actually used. And then I told him the movies, the CGI, and a lot of stuff, the workstations, even Windows workstations, which were used for rendering graphics back then, were using OpenGL, not DirectX. So yeah. There's a lot of ignorance.
Yeah, and I've heard that before, the argument that in many ways DirectX, depending on which version, of course, you're talking about, is superior, both from a programming standard and from a graphical standard, to OpenGL, which may or may not be true, but let's say that it is. So the question is it worth it to use a closed library, to give up that control and potentially put yourself in the situation where if you did decide to actually port your DirectX game to a system that did not support DirectX, now you're going to have to add some sort of layer in your code. So you're going from your code to DirectX to this, this middle layer, and then to OpenGL, just to get it to work, which obviously is like terribly inefficient and crazy, and it gives you a ton more work to do. Is it worth it for it to be a little bit easier to program, and for your model to look a little bit extra shiny, or your lighting to look a little bit extra better? And I don't think it's worth it at all. And in game design, nobody cares anyway.
Well, today we have game engines and they use whatever it's available. For example, I remember back then when I played Unreal, then Unreal Tournament, Unreal Tournament 2003, which you could mess with the advanced settings and configure which of the video output systems you would use. So you could choose OpenGL, 3DFX, Direct3D. You could choose software rendering. You had all the choices. And that was independent of the game code. So the engine was able to use any of those. But if you're going to write it from scratch and you're going to use only DirectX, then I don't think it's worth it if you plan to develop for consoles or for other platforms.
Yeah, for any system that's not owned by Microsoft, basically.
Yeah.
And you got to consider that Apple, of course, uses OpenGL. And there's a lot of Apple devices out there, whether you're talking about their MacBooks or their whatever they call their desktop systems, to their phones. I'm pretty sure they're not running DirectX, though I could be wrong. I doubt they are. But on to other news. Apparently, releasing a lot of remasters these days. Apparently, they're releasing a StarCraft Remastered Edition, which is cool, but kind of weird, because like StarCraft 2 is getting a lot of play. And while I haven't played it, I did play the original StarCraft. And from what I know, StarCraft 2 actually isn't too horrifically different from the first one. They did their best to try to preserve as accurately as possible what made the first one so great when they made the second one. So my question is, if they remaster the first StarCraft, so all the graphics are, modern, how is it going to compare to StarCraft 2? What are the remaining differences going to be? And why would anybody want to get StarCraft remastered if they've been playing StarCraft 2 for years now?
Well, I think the issue or the thing is, we see a lot of games getting remastered recently, not only games, but movies. I'm seeing a trend there. There might be just running out of ideas and trying to bring the old stuff to the younger people. Because, let's face it, it takes a lot of education to get people to appreciate old technology.
It can. I mean, some things age better than other things. You know, there's things I used to like. I go back and I see them now and I'm like, wow, like, how did I ever watch this crap? And there's other things and they're still good.
Yeah, there are things when the gameplay is good, the game ages very, very good.
Sure. Like StarCraft is still awesome.
It ages nicely. But even then, the... I remember reading Mike McShaffrey's book, Game Coding Complete. There's a part of the game which he calls the sexy part. And that's the issue we have now. The pixels aren't sexy for the younger masses. So they don't get attracted to the game because the pixels to them look dated, look obsolete. They don't have the mentality to appreciate pixel games. So developers are trying to make them look like something they would appeal to, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that could be part of it. But at the same time, if you have StarCraft 2, why are you going to remaster StarCraft 1? The little kiddies, they're already playing StarCraft 2. So in this particular example, I would think it would be more about just trying to squeeze the last little bit of blood out of an old game, and that it's actually geared towards people who did play the original StarCraft. You know, so they could go back and say, oh, I loved the original, haven't played it in God knows how many years. I'm not sure when it came out. A long time ago. I was in high school, so it would have come out like in the 1990s, between 91 and 94, probably, 90 and 94. But hell, I mean, that's one I might actually play, because StarCraft is just a great game. Well-balanced, simple, but what do they say, you know? Easy to learn, difficult to master. It's one of those types of games. But yeah, as far as like the obsolescence of pixel art outside of the, you know, trend towards retro these days with small studios going back and faking pixel art, basically most of it. Depending on what it is, I think kids actually won't be turned off by it. Like Jeffrey, you know, he loves the original Super Mario Brothers on my actual NES. He loves it. And I think the only reason for that is because of the great gameplay and the catchy music. He's never said, hey, the graphics are bad or this doesn't look right. He's never said anything like that to me at all. It looks like a Withstand the Fury pop back in. I don't know if he's lurking or if he fell down and unmuted himself by accident and he hit the keyboard.
He was unmuted from the beginning.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Okay, shows how much attention I'm paying. But yeah, like another remaster, like the subject of this podcast was supposed to be about the Planescape Torment remaster where they did the same thing. I actually haven't played that game. Have you played that?
No.
Okay. Well, not much to talk
about.
I've
only heard the title several times, and I heard about a project by the same team, newer one, which was funded on Kickstarter.
Yeah, I remember that.
Torment Tides of Numenera.
Yeah. I think Linguistic Dragon is all about those games.
I actually messed around with the rules from Numenera. And honestly, from the stuff that I play tested, it was really crappy. Honestly, it looked like the outdoor Montecook, he didn't deliver the promise he made. And what he was showing is, I don't know, it's like, how could I say? it's something like falling in love, or in the terms of game design, it's like having your mom for playtester. Your mom will always praise you for what you're doing and will say it's great, that you're doing great, and blah, 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 and will not point what's wrong with your game or whatever you're doing.
Yeah, and her son has just been charged with murder, but he's a good boy. He wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I think Montecook suffered from that with Numenera. Well, at least from the time I play tested the rules. The rules were so broken that we had to do a lot of house ruling, and the manual said that actually that it was okay to do the hand ruling, the house ruling, and a friend of mine is the one who introduced us to that, as he was the scribe and he was a supporter of the project, and he was using us as guinea pigs for that. And really, we didn't like it because it depended too much on game master judgment.
Mm.
It left too much to the game master's judgment. And it was designed that way. So it wasn't like, oh, this thing is not specific, or this thing is missing, so we will have to house rule or patch it for this specific situation, and there we go. That's working. We go on with the game. It was nothing like that. The manual, the rules actually say it's up to the game master to decide this or that. And I say that's bullshit. That leaves aside the player agency and leaves the game master as some sort of control freak. So that kind of game would only attract control freaks. And I really don't like to play with a game master who is a control freak. That's right. A shitty game.
Yeah, that's not necessarily true, though. I mean, in the context of my experience being a dungeon master for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, like back in the, late 80s, early 90s, like I would run my games like that. And the reason I would do it, and of course it was an odd reason, is I actually did not want to take the time to learn all of the rules. So what I would do is, use the ultimate computer, the human brain, to try to figure out, what is the most reasonable, logical, and palatable result of this player choosing to do an action. If you leave a lot up to the game master's discretion, that could be good or it could be bad. Like, if the players don't know the rules themselves, it wouldn't make any difference. They're not trying to game the system. They don't understand the underlying rules anyway.
Yeah, or even if the players are well-versed on the rules, even if they know the rules, on that kind of system, they know the game. It's up to the game master to decide. That's completely not empowering.
It's okay, let's say this. Let's say you have like 3 hit points and you roll, and you get hit for 4 points of damage. You're dead. Well, what if that character dying at that moment wasn't conducive to the party actually having a good time? So, the game master could say, oh, rules are the rules, you're dead, and actually completely ruin the entire experience for everybody. Or they could roll the dice behind the curtain where the players actually don't get to see the result, or let the player roll the dice and the players actually don't know how that's going to affect them. And the guy's like, you're knocked out, like you're unconscious, but you're not killed. If that's a net positive for the experience in the story, then I think that's an important call, and you should have the freedom to make that.
But that's a completely different issue. That's not what I am talking about. You have to see the rules to see how bad they are. It's not about the game master controlling that stuff. It's about you don't know crap about how you're going to do something, or if you are even able to do something. And it's up to the game master to decide. So it gives a lot of work to the game master, too much work.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, if the game master is not very experienced,
right, it'd be a horror show.
It leads to disaster.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So yeah, it's a broken game, or at least it was when we tested. And okay. I'm not talking about the early rules. They were already after several iterations. I have a friend who is very, very picky on the rules. He was here once. He's the author of the Games People Play comic. He is very special in terms of role-playing games, rules, and everything. And that was the first time he actually allowed the other guy to run the game, to run a game using the Numenera rules.
Mm.
And even if he found them mildly acceptable, the game we played was simply crap, because the game masters was really not experienced enough to do things properly.
Well, apparently one man's crap is another man's treasure. A lot of people apparently like the game. Although it was Stan the Fury Dragon said he had no idea why Planescape Torment anyway was considered like one of the best RPGs of all time. Based on my discussions with Linguistic about it, it's more about like the character conversations and things like that. That it's extremely dialogue heavy. There's a lot of interesting choices and conversation that way.
For those who love reading
and
having for those that love reading and knowing the backstory and all that stuff, I can imagine it's a great game. But I guess there are different tastes to that. For example, you tell me that Linguistic says it's dialogue heavy and all that stuff. I remember spending hours in Baldur's Gate 2 on a single dungeon, reading the books on the library and spending a very long time going through each individual book. And because I like reading, knowing, but some people might not like that.
I like it if it's a choice.
Yeah,
like, I don't like to be forced to go through it.
Yeah, in the case of the books, they are a choice. They are there, and you can pick them up or you can leave them there and untouched.
But, it's pretty much the way Ultimate did it.
Yeah, but when it comes to NPC dialogue, then that might be a different story.
Yeah, Ultimate 6 and 7 are when it got like really dialogue heavy, but it was just enough that it wasn't annoying and you could like get out of it at any time or, you know, drill down into exactly what you were looking for. So I think they handled it extremely well in that. Probably like the worst example of how it's handled, I guess, would be the Metal Gear series of games, the later ones. Because it wasn't even just text that you could just scroll through really fast. It was like an entire, epic cutscene. It was like 30 minutes long and you can't skip it. And you're just like, oh my God, I just want to hide in the locker somewhere and then stab somebody. And, you know, it's like, why do I have to go through this? Just let me play the damn game. But, yeah, that was crazy. But onto something different, because we're officially out of subjects now. So the only thing I got is what I've been working on forever. Stan the Fury can cut this or do whatever the hell he wants to with it, obviously. But there recently has been an explosion in the emulation scene with regard to 240p, And if anybody out there doesn't know what 240p is, basically in the NTSC standard, think your old yellow RCA cable input, your composite input, or your S-video input on your traditional old giant heavy CRT television. Like when you were a kid and you played Nintendo or Sega Genesis, the giant TV, right? That's a standard definition television.
Fat TV.
what's that?
The fat TV.
Yes, yes. It would basically accept a 480i or display a 480i signal, which is 480 vertical lines interlaced.
Horizontal lines.
Vertical, okay, rows, yeah, all right. Horizontal lines, 480 rows. And it would draw the even field, 30 frames per second, and it would draw the odd field, 30 frames per second. So you would get a 60 frames per second interlaced signal. And if you're watching like a video, you know, on VHS, right, it would look fine. It would look great. But if you hooked a computer up to it or something like that, if your video card had the television output and you tried to display the equivalent of pixel art, like a word processor, or if you were emulating an old video game, it would give you this nausea-inducing flicker. You could actually see the even and odd fields rapidly flickering at Well, 240p was basically a modification, an NTSC hack, if you will, that console developers figured out from the earliest consoles, like from Atari through NES, Super Nintendo, all the way up to the PlayStation 1, where instead of it drawing the even and odd lines on different fields, they would draw them both on the same field. And because they were all being drawn in the same field, that was what would create these black horizontal lines, or what are improperly but commonly referred to as scan lines now. And that's been like the holy grail of emulation and retro gaming for people who aren't using original hardware for a long time. Well, two things happened, and the existing solutions are absolutely horrific. We're talking about an HDMI to VGA converter attached to a scan converter, which is this, you know, $500 box that you get from somewhere. And it's just, it was an absolute mess. You'd end up spending a lot of money and it still wouldn't work. Well, a guy named Popcorn Mix on GitHub recently, I guess he's with the Raspberry Pi team because its firmware apparently is a closed binary blob. He, upon request, made a modification of the Raspberry Pi firmware to allow 240p output over the Raspberry Pi's composite, integrated composite output, mode 16 for NTSC and mode 18 for PAL. And it works incredibly well. So if you're using RetroArch, which is a great emulator for multiple systems, nice graphical front end, it works great. But even better than that, a guy named Mike Chi actually designed and fabricated himself a hat for the Raspberry Pi, which is a board that plugs into a row of pins on the Raspberry Pi called the GPIO pins for general purpose input output. He created a hat that plugs into that that has three digital to analog converters, one for composite, your yellow RCA cable, one for S video, and one for component, your red, green, and blue cables for the higher end SDTVs that came out before they stopped manufacturing them. And it basically converts the Raspberry Pi's VGA signal that you can pull from the GPIO pins. It converts that simultaneously and outputs the signal out over composite component and S-video. And I've been testing that with RetroArch and tweaking the settings for the NES and Super Nintendo, and I've actually been able to reproduce those systems one for one perfectly against original hardware, including the scale, the position, and the scan lines, with no artifacting whatsoever.
Pretty cool stuff.
Hey, and he's back. What's up with Stan the Fury? Just in time, too. The tank was on fumes.
Well, there we go. Yeah, I see Golden Flame had to bow out. So, oh, well, yeah, that's fine. So, obviously, you were talking about your RPi project again, and probably more generally just the whole concept of retro gaming.
Yeah, I was trying to break it down because a lot of people don't know what any of that is, and they don't know why it's important. So I was trying to sum that up as best I possibly could.
What's the way to get 60 frames per second?
Yeah, you're getting a 60 frames per second progressive signal for old games on a standard definition television. So Super Mario Brothers runs liquid smooth. You can make those tight, crazy jumps no problem. And, you know, for not very much money.
Emulator, the Nesticle emulator for the NES. And it had a video mode which was 256 by 256. And it actually had scan lines. It was dual strike.
Double strike, right.
Yeah. And it looked great on the CRT. And also I used that on LCD.
Interesting. What did it look like on an LCD?
It looked fine, but it was a bit blurry because of the way the LCD scaled the image to fill the whole screen. And also, there were some LCD screens on which it didn't work. You see, some LCD screens properly displayed the screen with scan lines and everything on full screen, and there were others which displayed the image twice.
Yeah, it looks like it was relying on the LCD's built-in capability to display like odd screen modes and refresh rates. So like the blurriness, it wasn't like a software bilinear filter. It was like actually the monitor's chipset trying to deal with arbitrary screen modes being sent to it.
Yeah.
Which of any of the articles that I fired out there did you get to discussing?
We actually talked about all of them, believe. Yeah, the Super Nintendo game that was discovered that was apparently a port of an old Amiga game. We didn't have much to talk about.
Oh, is that what it was?
Quick the Thunder Rabbit.
Yes.
Which it's a port of an. Oh, go ahead.
Oh. It just strikes me as having been based on the Nestle Quick. Looks very...
Oh, you're right. I didn't even catch that. That's weird. I wonder if they licensed that. Probably not.
I look forward to hearing the reactions about Bloodstained, although I'm sure that didn't come as a surprise.
Yeah, yeah. One thing I was asking, and Gardia wasn't sure, is like, how well did the Wii U actually do? Because it seems, without me knowing the dates, that it was actually somewhat short-lived time frame-wise with the Switch coming out.
Well, apparently it pushed about 13.5 million units, which is not that good. By Nintendo standards, by comparison, the Nintendo 3DS, this is from VG247. So yes, the Wii U sold about 13.56 million units sold about 96.52 million units of software titles as of December 31st, 2016.
Yeah, actually, I have the vague remembrance of looking at the sales numbers for the 3DS. And it actually was higher than the PS4 sales.
Yeah. Well, maybe. I'll see if I can find the PS4 sales. But here's what I have for the 3DS. Again, VG247's article. I'll put a link in the show notes. And again, as of December 31st, 2016. So Wii U, 13.56 million units hardware and 96.52 million units software. Now, those sound like respectable numbers. Here's the 3DS. 65.30 million units hardware, 320.96 million units software.
Yes.
And while I'm at it, PlayStation 4 sales. Let's say units sold. Let's try that. Oh, Wikipedia, list of best-selling game consoles. All right, there you go. PlayStation 2 is evidently topping the list of, at least according to Wikipedia, the PlayStation 2 is still the top dog at more than 155 million units sold, although the Nintendo DS is breathing right down its neck at 154.02.
Moving on down.
Yeah,
I can believe that for the PlayStation 2, because even after the PlayStation 3 came out, there were still plenty of titles being developed for the PS2. They're developing for both systems simultaneously.
Yeah. Now, actually, so Nintendo has a fair number in the top 10 here. So Nintendo DS at 154.02 million hardware units sold. Game Boy Color combined between them, 1.18.69 million. The Wii, 101.63 million, pretty decent. And then, hang on, let me just count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Oh, okay. Game Boy Advance coming in next. This is at the number 9 spot, 81.51 million. And number 10, Nintendo 3DS, 65.30 million hardware units sold. So Wikipedia has the same number that VG247 was quoting, which, yes, exceeds the PlayStation 4. After the 3DS, the next best-selling system is the original NES, 61.91 million units, and then PS4, 53.4 million.
Yeah, considering that the NES came out in the mid-80s, those are incredible sales figures, because the industry hadn't blown up yet like it has now. So you're dealing with like a smaller market base.
Yeah,
I'd actually like to see
the industry.
Yes, I'd actually like to see those sales figures scaled for how big the market was at the time.
Well, okay. So what are you talking about? Like, say the NES?
Yeah, like how many people were actually playing video games at all versus how many systems were sold? Like that ratio.
I can't
really... It's almost like inflation, kind of.
Well, yeah, okay. I can't really do inflation, but I can sort this list, thanks Wikipedia, by date. And so, like, if you look at the next console they list, or the console they list immediately prior to the NES, by date, is the Atari 5200, 1982. And then also the ColecoVision. Okay. So Atari 5200 and ColecoVision, both from 1982. ColecoVision, a little over 2 million. Atari 5200, 1 million. And then 1 year later, the NES, 61 million. But equally, if we step back in time a little bit more to 1977 and the Atari 2600, 30 million units. So pretty respectable there.
Yeah, because the farther back you go, there were significantly less people interested in video games at all.
And then if you go forward in time from the NES, you get like the Sega Master System, 10 to 13 million units, TurboGrafx-16, about 10 million units. And then Sega Genesis pops up at 30.75 million units. So there's now, of course, that one got stomped by the Game Boy Color. But still, that's a lot of units moved. The Super NES moved 49 million units. Original PlayStation, 102.49 million. Poor Sega Saturn at 9 million. Nintendo 64, 2 million. So, I mean, even if you go by, like, even if you just, yeah, like if you go by overall units sold from top to bottom, just looking here for Nintendo, yeah, the Wii U is definitely bringing up the bottom at 13.56 million. Well, I mean, technically the Switch is currently at the bottom with 2.5 million units sold. But seeing as how it launched last month, you know, that's fine.
I want to see some graphs and extrapolations and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So actually, I did have a few links related to that. Let me see here. Nintendo is currently doubling production of Switch units, it would seem.
Good.
Yes. So let me just see here. Yes, Nintendo will be, so this is evidently reported in WSJ, the Wall Street Journal. Nintendo will be ramping up production of Switch units from 8 million to 16 million from the period of April 1st to March 31st of next year. So, I mean, doubling down. Evidently, they're fairly confident in the hardware.
I'm still waiting. Like, I loved it when Nintendo was king. With the NES and the SNES. I loved it. I loved the other systems too, but I really miss the days when, you know, Nintendo was it. And it pains me to watch them struggling over a long period of time, you know, trying to come close to regaining that title. And, you know, I keep hoping. I was super excited about the Wii. you know, the original Wii, which, you know, was and is a great system. So hopefully the Switch will do it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it certainly seems to be doing well for them, at least to start. Like, it pushed 1.5 million units, I think, in its first week. And, you know, obviously they're doubling production, so they're expecting to sell a fair chunk of hardware. Now, you know, granted, 2.5 million units currently sold, ramping up production with another 16 million unit. Let's assume they sell them all. That's still only going to push it into about GameCube territory. But then, I mean, you know, given the lifetime of your average console, they could still wind up doing very, very well by the Switch.
Yeah, I think Nintendo may be underestimating, some would probably argue the opposite, but might be underestimating just how many sales were actually driven by an incredibly unique system-exclusive title. So for something like, I mean, hell, if you think about the original NES, there were so many good games.
Yes.
You didn't feel bad about getting the system. You knew you were taken care of. It wasn't a problem. And on top of that, if you bought a competing system, there was a good chance that you either weren't going to get the same game or it'd be kind of the same, but not really. So like with Breath of the Wild, you know, if that's as good as people are saying it is, I hope that'll be a massive driver of sales for the system.
Yes. And apparently about, it looks currently like in terms of uptake, and again, hang on, I just saw this in an article too. Ah, where is it? Ah, yes, okay. So this is at Hardcore Gamer. In addition to the rampant pre-orders that built on sales for the Switch, an estimated 89% of Switch owners purchased Breath of the Wild, meaning about 1.34 million owners, Switch owners, have a copy of the game upon release.
So, that's pretty close to 100.
Yeah, that's close enough to 100 for our purposes.
Yes. Now, if they can just figure out how to, you know, pull a rabbit out of their hat, not repeating that, then I think they'll be well taken care of.
Yep. Now, equally, there's a comment at Hardcore Gamer, which I do actually agree with. I made the mistake of reading the comments, but in this case, it was a good one. just remember, I'm quoting now, just remember how it sells now is not super important. It is how it is selling 6 months from now that matters. It was destined to sell out whatever they had to sell. So, and I mean, to be fair, that's true because Nintendo does like to play a little bit of a game with supply when they launch a new product. Actually, they just like to play games with supply in general, but
artificial scarcity.
Yeah. So I guess in a certain sense, yes, it was probably true that the Switch was going to be a hard thing to come by, you know, if you didn't pre-order it for the first month after its launch. And even if you did pre-order it, right, because they only accepted so many pre-orders. So it'll be interesting to see once this mainline production has ramped up and once the console is, you know, I can just walk into Walmart and buy it, how well it sells at that point.
If I was in charge, I would go full retro forward. I would have new versions of Metroid, side-scrolling with 3D graphics, of course, but side-scrolling so the gameplay was the same as Super Metroid and the original Metroid. I'd go in with Double Dragon, beat 'em up, side-scrolling Contra, just like every top-selling game, side-scrolling Castlevania, every top game like that, treat it the same way that they treat new Super Mario Brothers, where, you know, it's got a lot of new snazzy stuff. It does use 3D graphics, but the gameplay, which is what made the games great, is essentially identical to the original game. If they can do that with every hard-hitting title that still withstands the test of time, I think they'll have a solid library to suck people in. Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but that's what I would do.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong. I think that, I mean, especially because it's Nintendo, because, like, I mean, not that there aren't iconic games on other platforms, but it seems to me, at least, and I am a bit of an outsider, so maybe I'm in error in this in terms of actual raw numbers, but it seems to me, at least, that Nintendo, above and beyond any of the other console systems on the market, has a exceedingly large stable of iconic games, right?
They do. Between
the Zeldas, the Marios, the Metroids, yeah.
Between the NES and the SNES, that alone, the library is insane. Talking like thousands of games.
Exactly. And so it's kind of just, it's really a case, to my mind, at any rate, of, you know, yeah, I mean, they should really try and capitalize on that. And I know they do have stuff in the pipeline. There is a new Mario game in the pipeline. There is a new Mario Kart in the pipeline. I haven't heard anything about Metroid, but I can imagine it's only so long. But I guess that remains to be seen. You know, we'll follow up in like October and see where things are at.
Yeah, I'd like to get one. What's the price point right now for the Switch?
I think it's like still
200, around 300.
Well, it's around $400 for me. So, and that's Canadian. So, I mean, for you, I don't know, somewhere in the 300 less range. Yeah.
Okay. So it's a beefy system then.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, I mean, in terms of price point, yeah, it is. So, but then again, the new Xbox is probably going to set, you know, people back in Canada, if I had to guess, $600-$700. I think the price point for the US is $599.
Wow.
I could be wrong. Don't quote me on that. I only saw like one article about Project Scorpio, but anyways. Well, if you like spam, spam, spam humbug, and we hope that you do, we do invite you to please consider supporting the podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/UltimaCodex, which, as you can infer from the URL, also helps support the Ultima Codex, the major hub of news for all things Ultima and Ultima fan project. But if Patreon's monthly subscription model ain't your thing, you can also, because I'm assuming if you're listening to a podcast about video games and old video games in particular, you might consider buying your video games, especially your old classic video games, at GOG.com. There'll be a link in the show notes. And if you go by that link to buy your games, we get a little bit of commission off of that. And it all helps pay for the podcast hosting and occasionally new equipment and site hosting and, you know, all of those things that allow us to bring content to you. But if nothing else, we do welcome your moral support. As I mentioned at the start of the episode, reviews. Please do leave us a review on iTunes. Leave us a rating. It all helps to add to the visibility of the podcast. And share us on social media. You can find, you can like Ultima on Facebook, facebook.com/theUltimaSeries, and you can follow at Ultima Codex on Twitter. And I do invite you again to share anything that gets posted there, whether it's a podcast episode, whether it's some interesting bit of news, which I'm always trying to post. Just, you know, share that out on your own social media feeds. Now, if you want to join the Ultima community, UDSC.org is your gateway to selecting and having forever registered on the grand roster your very own dragon name. You can also join the Ultima Dragons on Facebook or on Google Plus. There are groups on both platforms. You can follow at Ultima Dragons on Twitter. There's a pretty much dead Slack channel and a rather more lively Discord server where the Ultima Dragons do occasionally hang out. And if you really want to go old school, you can find them on the Wear Mount. You will, however, need a Telnet client to access it. And finally, you can send us feedback. Send us an email at ultimacodex@gmail.com, or you can go to podcast.ultimacodex.com, and there will actually be a link that will take you to a page where you can leave us a voice message. You can send us a message, record up to 90 seconds of audio in your browser, and I'll work it into a future episode. Finally, you can join us on our Discord server. That's where we record these episodes, and we are certainly very welcoming of people who just want to lurk and listen to the audio as it happens. All right, Boolean, where can we find you online?
Well, first, as far as people leaving reviews, I think it might be kind of cool to incentivize people to do so by having us read those reviews, within reason, obviously, on the podcast.
Oh, that is not merely implied. That will, in fact, happen.
Yes, either to thank them or to address them in some other way, but, you know, that'd be cool, I would think. But, yeah, you can find me at 8virtues.com if you need a Linux-based PC, on Facebook under 8virtues, 8V Radio, or Kevin Fishburne, and on YouTube as Voss Corp Bet Money.
All right. And how about yourself, Gradia?
You can find me on Facebook as Shengnam Gradia, or here on Discord, Gradia Dragon.
Brilliant. And I know Golden Flame Dragon had to leave, but you can, of course, find his project at Tapestry of Ages I believe, .com. He is on Twitter and Facebook. You can find him under the label of the game that he is working on, The Dark Unknown. And he is also on SoundCloud as well. I will make sure to include links to all of his profiles and, of course, the Tapestry of Ages Games website in the show notes. And, of course, you can find me on Twitter, at WTF_Dragon. I'm also on Facebook. I have an about.me splash page that links to various other of my social media profiles. And, of course, you can find me at ultimacodex.com or at scoutingstuffpodcast.com. That's the other podcast that I run, and it talks about what else, scouting, Scouts Canada, and occasionally scouting in other parts of the world as well. Well, thank you all for listening. And thank you, Kevin and Gridia, for, you know, and Golden Flame, you know, whenever you get around to listening to the episode, for carrying the majority of this episode through, because again, I did have to step away. So I'm grateful that we have this model that actually probably works, or will probably work most of the time that we have to rely on it. Because you know what, with the baby coming in summer, I may wind up having to just rely on you guys to carry the podcast through more often than I have to date. We'll see.
Well,
you know.
Well, to quote Predator, anytime, anytime, anytime.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you again. And thank you everyone out there for listening. And until next time, be virtuous.